Welcome to Credit Exchange, your weekly podcast where we speak to the biggest newsmakers and news shapers in finance to discuss the important topics in markets. I'm your host, Lisa Lee. This week, my guest is Joel Holzinger, co-head of alternative credit at Ares Management, one of the true pioneers in the private credit space and in the forefront of the revolution that has transformed lending. Welcome, Joel.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, Lisa.
Joel, earlier this week, as we tape on February 25th, equity markets swooned in part because of a Substack post. That wasn't even a forecast, but a scenario that painted a dystopian scenario about AI. And then Mark, Dow Jones Industrials fell, so did the S&P 500, NASDAQ. And less known, so did credit markets. And unlike equities, credit markets kept on falling, at least the public side. Joel, as someone who's been investing for as long as you have, how do you make sense of a market that would fall or move on a Substack post? And how do you invest in that?
Yeah, it's interesting. There's been lots of analogies made, you know, by news and others, you know, to the questions of, are we GFC-like? Are we dot-com-like? Are we going through these different situations? And, you know, I read the same paper that you're mentioning, and as everybody kind of read, and it honestly, it was more reminding me of Cyberdyne and Terminator.
Yes, very, right. It's very science fiction.
It was very dystopian. It was very science fiction. And it's funny because, you know, I get a lot of, I get a lot of people who consider me slightly perma-bearish. And when I finished reading that paper, I thought, wow, I feel very bullish compared to this paper on when it went. But, you know, I've been doing this for a long time. I came out of college in 1997. So this is my 29th year. And I actually do remember moments like this.
Oh,
and,
really?
Here's the difference. The difference is it happened in the end of .com. But it happened because of some blog post. It happened because of comments that were going on with regards to some rumor mill on some of the underlying venture and some of the .com type companies. And it was moving markets on a daily basis when it really got to this period of volatility. So I think that, you know, the reminder is that, you know, to me, there's the public equity markets and then there's everything else. And the thing that's overestimated is what we've seen over the last 20 plus years is the shrinking of the public equity markets. Yes, the market caps go up. Yes, the enterprise values have gone up, but the number of companies continues to shrink. You know, when you sit there and you think of there's only about 6,000 companies that are represented. And if you think of the S&P 500, when you're investing in an S&P 500 index, people look at that as, wow, I'm investing in 500 companies. Well, five companies make up about a third of the valuation. And so it does go to how concentrated the public equity markets have become as so many more companies have gone to the private markets and how in the end, as an investor, you really can't access the markets if you're only investing that 3 or 4% of the market and you're not investing the 95% plus that actually exists within the private credit markets. And so that's why you see this volatility because, you know, is AI a bubble? I'm not the person. It's not my background to attest. Is the valuation a bubble? You know, look, AI is very real. It's going to impact things. We're going to continue to see that. But if you look at it from where we are today to where it goes into the future, you're going to see a lot of things change. If you look at the .com, who got the last round of valuation is the only reason Amazon exists today.
Oh, that's an interesting point, right?
There's a great book that talks about Amazon and the Everything Store. And if they had not gotten their last round, they wouldn't have existed. They would have gone away. And I do think that there are some hefty valuations on some of the AI companies, both in the venture land as well as some of the public related tied to the Mag 7 and others. But to me, that's the noise of the V, the valuation moving around, the valuation of the markets. That's the difference of the public equity markets and what you see in private markets and especially across private credit. It's a very different. I look at it as one of our mantras we talk about all the time in our lessons learned, and we publish these, is buy assets and cash flow. The rest is noise. To me, the AI is going up and down in the valuation, especially on companies. When you think of the valuations of Anthropic and you think of the valuations of OpenAI, where they have $8 billion of revenue and $4 billion of revenue, and they lose $8 billion of cash flow and $4 billion of cash flow. Like, that's not assets and cash flow yet. And it's the hope of assets and cash flow.
Well, right now, everything is trading on hope and now hoping on fear, because actually, corporate profits are doing really well. When you look at earnings seasons, and they have performed astonishingly well, at least the U.S. corporate market, and the economy is booming. I mean, like, okay, 4Q wasn't great growth, but it is solid growth. And we have the one big beautiful bill, the tax returns from those. So it seems like the backdrop is positive for growth and for investing, but yet this fear seems to have gripped the markets. But Joe, let's move to the private credit markets, because you mentioned that. There's some fears waffling over there too, because of AI. So how should we think about private credit when there's a lot of fear now about how AI might disrupt this space as well?
Yeah, you have to go to kind of perceived risk versus actual risk. And when you look at the perceived risk versus actual risk, there's clearly a lot of headlines that have gone out. But I think when you go to actual risk, you have to think of the fundamentals of credit. And the fundamentals of credit is whenever you're looking at an asset, there's always a lot of attention put at the asset level. But in many ways, when you think of finance, when you think of credit, we have a mantra. We say money makes the world go round. Credit makes money go round. Every asset is valued off of credit. But what's more important in many ways is how is that credit financed? How is that asset financed? And so if you're a bank, you're 15 to 20 times leveraged and you're borrowing short and lending long. There's always systematic risk in banks, because in the end, they're borrowing short and lending long. There's always an asset liability mismatch. If you think of what happened in 2022, it's almost forgotten at this point. If you think of the regional bank crisis, we had three of the four largest bank failures ever in history because of banks that were perfectly healthy, but fears of ALM, fears of asset liability mismatch and others. So if you look at insurance, you're matched, you know, on annuities and others, you're 15 times leveraged, but you're matched. You know, you issue 3, 5, 7 year liabilities. If you're mortality, which is life insurance and others, you're issuing obviously 20 or 30 year liabilities and you're matching it. So there's always some variation on the matching. You know, the assets may move around on duration or other things, but you are more levered. You're 15 times leveraged. The thing that is most misunderstood when people use the term private credit is that the most levered most private credit is 1-to-1 or a little bit more, which is your private BDCs and others. And most funds have no leverage to them. So those same assets, if you go back 29 years ago, I got my start with Citigroup. I was doing the same kind of lending within asset-based finance that I do today on a bank's balance sheet at tighter spreads than we have today on the assets. The difference was the ROEs, the IRRs, were driven off of that leverage. It was driven off of that 15 to 20 times leverage. So in many ways, the market is safer than it's been because of that matched funding, because you don't have the implicit leverage within private credit that you do within banks and what you do within insurance. And you have more natural matched financing, both through insurance as well as securitization markets and private credit. The systematic risk always sits in asset liability mismatch, which always sits a little bit more in banks and other areas, or when you take too much of a good thing on financing.
Well, that is good to know that you believe that it's not a systemic risk. I sort of agree with you as well. I think there's risk, and there should be any risk when you're investing. This is not a risk-free trade, and no one should think that. But moving over to ABF, which is asset-backed finance, which is the thing that you're in charge of, right? Because I found that I was teasing you before about your title, which is co-head of alternative credit. I think of Ares as an alternative credit shop, but you're not the CEO, Mike Arougheti is. So tell me, what is your job?
I don't have his head of hair. I have the silver head of hair. I don't have, you know, Kip and Arrow have dramatically better heads of hair. So no, I look at it as, you know, at Ares, alternative credit and what we call alternative credit is asset-based finance.
Okay.
And, you know, for those who aren't as familiar, asset-based finance is everything's a portfolio. It's loans, it's leases, it's receivables. The liquid part of our market is the asset-backed securitization market. The illiquid part of our market in the non-rated part of our market is where we make direct investments, not too different than what you'd see in direct lending or credit ops. But the difference is we're not doing single name corporates.
Talking about ABF, I've heard some people say that it's $6 trillion. I've heard others say it's more than $20 trillion. So that's a big gap between them. What is the size of the ABF market, according to Joel Holzinger?
Yeah, I think the recent numbers I've seen different people use is 10 to 40 trillion. We've used 28 trillion at our investor day, and that was made up. We did that as a bottoms up number. I think that sometimes where there's confusion is simple, which is if you look at our market, it includes everything in the asset-backed securitization market. It also includes things like residential mortgages, which is a very big asset class. When you include the liquid part of the market, when you include residential mortgage, then you'll get to the 20 to 40 trillion dollar number. The illiquid part of our market, the non-IG and the non-rated portion, that's generally call it a quarter to a third of that market. But what happens is when the asset-backed securitization market is on pause or shut down for any basis, a lot of that flows over. And all of a sudden, that market becomes dramatically larger. And that's the simplest reason when I think of dislocation. When I look at dislocation, I'm not looking at it as, say, as a distressed debt investor. We don't go buy, you know, distressed companies. We go buy really good, clean assets from sometimes distressed sellers and issuers. But what happens is when a trillion or 2 trillion drips into our market, that has a very big impact on supply and demand, and it widens spreads and it makes things more interesting. And so we always find things to do because we rotate on relative value across asset classes. But there's no doubt that you go to the supermarket and everything's on sale when you're in dislocation. You know, there's a lot you can look at, a lot to buy, and you can be very selective and frankly go up in quality on risk.
I was going to say, right now with all the uncertainty, there's a lot trading at a discount. So I was wondering, are you already ready to jump in and buy some of them, or are you going to wait a little longer? Or maybe you already are buying?
I would say there's stuff to do, but I would say one of the things that's interesting is, if you think of the notion of there's a lot on sale, there's actually not. You know, if you look at it, if you look at the underlying companies and you go away, it sometimes is lost because in the public markets, so much attention and so much news is put around the Mag 7 because it's trading the markets and that's the things, or maybe a random meme stock here or there, or sometimes the Mag 7s trade like meme stocks. But if you look in that market, there's a very different bifurcated. You got companies that are kind of just plodding along. You got companies that are growing like crazy. When you go to the private markets, whether it's private equity, private credit, whether what we do in asset-based finance, what you'll find is things are generally kicking along. And so what's happened is even with the news cycle, even with the dislocation, even with some change in the flows, as we call them, with supply and demand, you know, if you look at it, you know, corporate IG is at 1998 tights, you know, so we're still near tights on that. The asset-backed securitization market is still trading near tights across a lot of asset classes. If you were to say what's on sale, yes, some public equity, BDCs or others are on sale, but frankly, not a lot is. And honestly, if you've learned, you know, if you think back through history and you say, okay, what should I listen to, the equity markets or the credit markets? The answer is always the credit markets.
I know, right? The credit markets have been all better, much better canaries, much better forerunners.
And so I do think we've seen some noise and we've seen headlines and we've seen some situations. And I do think that leads to some frothiness. So in our world, in asset-based finance, a lot of that's more on the insurance side, the asset-backed securitization market. Because that market, you sell an annuity, you know, a 3, 5, 7 year annuity, and you go to match it with an asset. And then that ends up being something where, you know, you need to put that money to work to match it. And so it's almost hot potato-like. And so what has happened is you've had 4 or 5 years of record annuity sales, which has led to why is corporate IG at a 1998 tights in a market that has all of this noise going on? It has nothing to do with fundamentals. It has everything to do with flows. It's all about flows. So on that side, that market's coming in and tight, but it's because of flows. It will move the same way. If rates go down, flows will slow. And so I think that's the thing, is that we haven't really seen huge cracks yet in the underlying credit markets, either on fundamentals or on spreads. But you do expect, as your end of cycle, you'll see more news. And as I've said in another context, you know, normally the Warren Buffett line is when the tide goes out, you see who's naked. Right now, we're in the situation where the tide has not gone out. That's very clear. And underlying fundamentals are generally good. but you're seeing some random nudity on the beach.
That's a good point, right? And also fears of nudity. Oh my God, is he naked?
And here's the reality. The media is, you know, and including yourself and others, you're very voyeuristic.
You like that the is nude, true.
Right? Like you want to talk about the nude person on the beach. You don't want to talk about the tide. You don't want to talk about where we are broadly.
And talking about like AI, to keep on that tone, there is the fear of AI, but there's also the enthusiasm of AI. And a lot of that is directed towards data center financing and all the cap spending that's helping to actually drive some economic growth. And you're in charge of data center financing. So can we talk about data centers and is there still opportunities there? There's also the reverse fear that given some of the AI worries that there might not be enough financing for data centers and to meet the growth needs. We seem like a little bit constantly rushing from one fear to another, but data centers.
Yeah, so data centers and digital infrastructure generally, it's not just us and alternative credit. It actually touches parts of real estate. It touches, we have a digital infrastructure group that works on some development of data centers as well as we touch them across our infrastructure credit group in our infrastructure. So it kind of goes to data centers and infrastructure generally. The opportunity set is so big. It takes a village right now. And you're seeing it kind of touch all parts of the markets. We're seeing opportunities. You know, if you go back a number of years ago, we bought a big portfolio out of the regional bank crisis from PacWest, as well as we've been active early on, not as much more recently, on some significant risk transfers and SRT trades. What we're seeing now is banks trying to reduce their exposure across some of their data center names, not because of risk, not because of fears, because they want to buy more. Because they're already at capacity issues, because the opportunity set is so big. So I do think the thing that is going to happen is, frankly, if you think of the power demand that's needed, as well as the capital demand that's needed, frankly, I don't know that it's fully achievable at the levels that have been modeled in. And so I do think you're going to hit a little bit of a wall because of power. You're going to hit a little bit of a wall because of the sheer capital that's supposed to be there to finance that piece. And so right now, there's this huge demand and there's a lot of different projects. I think you'll see a slowdown of that because I think it's probably unsustainable for the sheer amount of capital that needs to go into these projects and the sheer amount of financing, as well as the amount of power that needs to be built. And frankly, the power is going to become more of a problem than the data centers. You know, the power needs to be there first. So we see it as a big opportunity, but we're being very selective on where we play. And one of the advantages of being in credit is where are we generally playing? Diversified portfolios where you're well inside the lease with a great counterparty. So do we know exactly what these assets are going to be worth in a number of years? No. Are we way inside that lease on a number of different assets? Yes. So that becomes more the equities problem than it is the debt or the credit problem. And so there's always places to play in that. And we do see continuing opportunities there. And they're all huge. The opportunities on those are very large.
And what do you say to people saying who say AI and this boom in AI is really should be an equity story and not a debt story? You shouldn't be financing what is so speculative.
Well, I think that when you think of data centers, again, a lot of the data centers being built have nothing to do with AI. They have everything to do with cloud. So, and in the end, sometimes there is revenue that's tied to those right now because effectively there's people who want usage of those. And so in the end, the lease becomes a small part of the payment that's there. I look at it more as the opportunities it's creating, you know, where there's exposure into other areas. And if in the end, you have an asset that has a lease on it and you're inside those lease payments with Microsoft, I'd rather be on that than trying to figure out what I think Anthropic is worth. You know, that's a very different counterparty. To me, that's a net lease asset, right? You're sitting there with a long-term lease with an IG counterparty and you're looking inside of that. Look, I think that we'll see a cooling down of that. And if you think of what we do broadly, fund finance, residential mortgages, consumers, and others. You know, we're always pivoting. We've been underweighted the consumer the last year and a half or so, but we've seen a lot of opportunities in fund finance. We've seen opportunities in short windows that I mentioned on SRTs. We've seen bank things. The window always changes. The key as an investor is you need to be able to pivot through these markets because the relative value by asset class, the relative value by size, the relative value even by geography of North America versus Europe is changing. The key is having flexible capital and scale. And whether it's in alternative credit at Ares, whether it's in our direct lending, whether it's in our InfraCredit group, the one thing that's common across the DNA of Ares is having flexible capital and size, that you can move into these markets where these shift, and you can go to the best relative value. But relative value isn't yield, it's risk. It's all about risk and it's all about downside. That's the difference of being in credit versus equity.
I've got to tell you, we are almost 20 minutes into this podcast, and something that has not yet happened since I started this in the beginning of 2025, we have not mentioned President Donald Trump. AI has pushed him out of, out of the beginning of my podcast, but there's been a lot of news. The Supreme Court just overturned the basis that President Trump for his sweeping tariffs that he imposed on Liberation Day last year. Now he's using Section 122, Section 301 for international trade gigs as to put 10 to 15% tariffs. We also have a possibility of war or conflict with Iran, and that will have repercussions for energy. These are all things that are geopolitical, macroeconomic picture. Tell me your forecast for that, because ABF to me touches so much of the economy. You must have a view on where the economy is going.
Well, I think that geopolitical is not the economy. And I think we've proven that over the years, which is if you think about it from a geopolitical standpoint, you know, we'll go back in history and we'll talk about the last 20 years. And this is something that we've heard almost nothing of for the last 2 years, which is the risk of North Korea. Or if we were to go broader, we would say, you know, risk of what we had in the Middle East or others. And we've continued to have noise. We've continued to have wars. We've continued to have conflicts. And we've had more than we've had in the past. But I actually think that as an investor, it does go a little bit to buy assets and cash flow. The rest is noise. In the end, you can't look at the wave in front of you when the boat's going up and down. You got to look at the horizon. You got to look at the horizon, and what you end up finding is most of the time from a geopolitical standpoint, it does become noise. I would say there are things that are tragic that don't actually affect the economy as much as we all talk about them. The Ukraine war is tragic, and it's been going on for 4+ years. We just had the anniversary. How much has it actually impacted markets? Very little. Very, very little. And if you think of all of the pieces that were written and all the pontifications with regards to what would occur both across fossil fuel markets, as well as across trade markets and even breadbasket and others, I think what we've shown, and probably the greatest example of this is coming out of COVID. There's a great book called by Will Drant, which is Lessons from History. And it talks about how man adapts, man moves forward. Humans adapt, humans move forward.
And we move forward from trade and some of the geopolitical risks. Markets are no longer caring.
And the reality is could we adjust? So if you think about it through COVID, if I told you 6 months beforehand, we'd all be wearing masks and working from home and not going out to restaurants and not going things, you'd say, wow, the GDP is going to go down by 30% and we're going to be worse than the Great Depression. But we adapt and we move forward. And I think we're a lot more adaptable than we realize. And if you think about it from the tariffs, yes, there's the 10 and the 15 and the new things that are coming through, but most of that's been priced in. And the reality is that only about 12 to 14% of the U.S. economy is imports. And so in the end, it's actually a relatively small part. So we see it on the individual things where the tariffs pass through, and it is a taxation that kind of ends up getting passed through long term. But I would argue even with the new taxation, many of these are just resetting levels to where they were. And so you're not going to see as big of an impact. And I do believe inflation is in the rearview mirror. But I also believe that we are in a slowing economy, right? We are in a jobs economy that is slowing. And some of that is you know, I'm sure going to be some job replacement. But a lot of that, frankly, is just where we are cycle. We're just end of cycle. Whether it occurs a year to now, 2 years from now, as an investor, you need to prepare and assume you're going into that. And you need to invest like you're going into that, which means you want to be in credit more than equity, right? Because the equity is the part that's volatile. I think the thing that's been lost in a lot of these markets is the equity is what owns it. Whether it's public equity or private equity, that's where a lot of the risk sits within, is sitting within those equity markets.
So you're bullish on credit, and I want to move to a different thing from investing, and that's your giving pledge?
Sure. If you go back 8+ years ago, and you've heard the story before, but not many people have, you know, I come from humble beginnings, and I did not know this world existed in any form or fashion. My dad was a pastor, my mom was a nurse. And, you know, we were on the low socioeconomic side of things in Boise, Idaho. And I was able to, you know, I was able to stumble backwards into finance. I was originally an engineer major, changed to finance, got a job with Citigroup out of college, and doors opened. And I've been very lucky to be where I am today. And I, if there's one thing, anybody who knows me, I love investing. I love credit. I love what I do every day. But I always wanted to come up with a way to do more. And I'd set it up 20 years ago to do it individually. My wife and I, her dad was originally from Peru. So she also felt lucky from that standpoint of, you know, she was a second generation immigrant. And we set it up where most of it was going to go towards health and education charities. And then before I joined Ares, I had an ask of Mike Arrighetti, our CEO, who I'd known for years and years prior to that, along with Kip and Mitch and Schmitty and a few others, which was, I said, I want to have a charity tie into whatever I do next. And it was inspired by a trip I did to India when I joined the board of Path Global Health, which is an amazing organization across, basically across vaccination programs across developing world. And we were working on a tuberculosis program as well as some stuff across HIV and others. And it really impacted me, you know, being in Dharavi in the largest slum in Asia, you know, and seeing there going, how could I do more, as much as I'd already set it up for that. So what we came up with when I joined was, I said, I'll do five if you do five. We did 10% of our family funds, 5% on another. So we have the Pathfinder family of funds where it's 5 to 10%, depending on the vehicle, that goes towards health and education charities, not just global, but US and global. And it's been amazing because that was 8+ years ago. And we really, you know, got that really starting in earnest for really right actually at COVID. The first closing on one of those funds was March 13th of 2020, to give you an idea. And now if you fast forward, you know, we're about $47, $48 billion across alternative credit. And almost half of that is inside the Pathfinder family of funds, where we're doing that. And we've accrued $40 million plus to charity that will come from that. And that's only the accrued to date, not including, you know, any potential stuff from there.
And on the Ares matches, right? That's the way structured.
So half of it comes from myself and half of it goes through Ares. But the coolest thing is that idea turned into what we have today in that scale. And so what's interesting is it started with an idea that turned into a fund series, that turned into an Ares Charitable Foundation. And then to go to where you were stating earlier, Lisa, we've been talking for years of how do we get others to do it? How do we inspire others to do it? Because we've talked to people about it. And what we came up with was, let's keep it simple. Let's keep it similar to the Giving Pledge or others, where we get others to pledge to make this same kind of pledge to do good and to do stuff across philanthropy. And what we came up with is we call it Promote Giving. We launched it October 15th of 2000 of last year. And when we launched that, we have 8 initial founding signatories, including Ares, including, as you mentioned, Collar, Pantheon, Silver Point, Mac Aurora, Derby Lane, Ascend, Pretium. I'm probably missing one, so I apologize if I did. And we had these initial 8 signatories where everybody's agreed to give at least 5% of their promote to philanthropy. It could be housing, it could be homelessness, health, it can be education, it can be climate. Everybody directs their own giving. But what we've really created is a community where we're sitting there saying, okay, let's drive the highest returns to our investors across all of the underlying funds. And when we do that, we'll drive the highest dollars to philanthropy. You're fully aligned. Because if you think of who our investors are generally pensions and endowments and insurance companies and others. We're already protecting the health and the education of underlying pensioners and underlying insurance companies and others. This is a way to also give money directly to philanthropy through those programs. And what it's amazing about it is the culture it creates.
Yes, let's talk about that because you know, you're giving money, but I know so many young people, and we've discussed this before, want to have some meaning in their life. And I think they're really enthused about participating and actually tangibly going places. And so tell me about the way you make your grants, because it's not just sitting in an office saying, you have your young staffers at Ares go and do field visits. And I like to talk about that.
Sure. Yeah, no, it's been amazing. And we've actually added, since the initial founding signatories, We have five groups that have verbally signed on and working through forms of documentation. One, 2C's Capital has fully signed as a new signatory. But to your point, if you go back to what we've done, if you look in 2025, we did 7 grants, a little over $4 million just out of one of that, a family of funds, out of one thing. The bigger dollars kind of come as we get later in the life of the funds. We did $4 million of grants. And so to your comment, you know, the team is very tied into this. So we have a team that it's all their volunteering, it's all their own time.
You pay for it, right? You pay for it, but their time is their time. And I think right now, time is the most precious thing, not so much the airfare.
Yeah, the capital comes from the house and comes from myself across the foundation, but we have them very involved as it relates to the underlying grants. And what we see with the grants is what we've taken as a catalytic approach of where can we help these different philanthropic organizations to basically bridge capital for them where we can have the biggest impact. So we actually go to them, these organizations we've gotten to meet over the last 8 years, with about 50 different groups that we've profiled and met and spent time with and diligenced. And like last year, we went to about 23 of those and we said, where can we be a catalyst at $250,000 to $1.5 million? And where can we do this across health and education, global and otherwise? And then we ended up choosing 7, but the team is selecting those. So we're selecting those, we're going through, same as we do with an investment committee. We're doing our diligence, we're doing our write-ups, we're narrowing it down. What's the best relative value? What's the best impact? And to give you an idea, like I look at it as there's a third of the team that loves what we do, but they want their bonus. There's a third of the team that thinks it's amazing and it's something they're very proud of and it's part of why they're here. There is a third of our team, it is the air they breathe. It is absolutely amazing. And to your point, that third especially are those who have gone to India and they've gone going to Bangladesh later this year. And when you're sitting there in Uttar Pradesh in India, and you're working with Educate Girls in a rural community where they're going door to door to get girls to go back to school and learn the value of education so they can get education and make more with their life and to do that, that's something that really sits with you. And when you're sitting in a neonatal unit and you're looking at a, you know, what's about a 2.5 pound baby, and you're sitting there going, hey, we can have an impact on this, on a program we're doing with PATH Global or with another group. And like last year alone, we did 7 grants. One of those grants was with Mount Sinai, and it's building a surgical center in Zimbabwe. One of those grants we did is a Rohingya refugee crisis with BRAC on sanitation. We've done programs on inline water chlorination with the government of India in AP, which is one of their biggest states. We've done stuff with Educate Girls, done stuff with Rocket Learning. We've done stuff with Child Life Foundation. We've done stuff with PATH and with Gates and with GiveWell. So like the impact you can have is very amazing. And we're working on 10 different grants this year across the US in that same kind of vein. That ability where you're working not just on the grants, but imagine you're working on a deal. And that deal you're working on, every single deal we do across that family of funds is driving those philanthropic dollars. And that's true with anybody who signs on to promote giving. It directly ties that work you're doing on that investment memo, that work you're doing on the individual transaction is directly driving those dollars in a longer term. And to me, that's something that really has that dual purpose.
And I would imagine the team that works on that deal together, they get closer as well, culturally. I have the same vision and not for, of course, I mean, I'm not knocking data center financing, but to be working together on something they feel so strongly about and passionate about must be a good cultural tie as well.
It becomes part of your culture. It becomes part of your DNA. You know, we focus a lot on having a credit DNA and an investor DNA, but it really goes to something of, I go to Jeremy Collar of Collar Capital is one of the signatories. And to his credit, he had a relatively large foundation. And so he's been living by this for a while, even though we inspired him to take the Promote Giving Pledge. And he's become a great friend and he's been an amazing partner with us. And we've done deals with them. We've done fund finance and other transactions with them. We've actually done close to $2 billion of deals with other signatories that we've done because you create this close-knit community. He says it best. Which is in the end, if you take away everything else we do day to day, and I love what I do and I love my job, I always used to say, there's only 3 things that really matter when you're 85. You know, it's not the Jeff Bezos a regret index. It's your close friends and family. It's your experiences, not your goods. And it's, did you give back? Did you mentor? Did you teach? Did you parent? Did you give to philanthropy, your time or your money? His is better. His version is, if you're 90 years old, he said he negotiated a few extra years. He's probably has. If you're 90 years old, is your 13-year-old self proud of what you've done? Would they be proud of that? And I look at my 13-year-old self, and I didn't even know this world existed. And I've been able to dream. I've been able to live at levels I couldn't even dream, you know, at that at 13, because I didn't know any of this existed. And I've been able to travel. I'd never left the country. I hadn't actually been on a plane at 13. And so my 13-year-old self, in the end, this is something you can be really proud of. This is something that every member of the team can be proud of. But more importantly, is your 90-year-old self looking back saying, I'm proud of what you did. You lived a good life. And those are the things that matter. So as much as we love the investing, that ability to kind of drive philanthropy, that ability to impact lives, that ability to do other things, it really does go to that dual purpose we're trying to accomplish.
Great. Thank you so much. And thank you for sharing so much with us, starting from AI to giving.
We have covered all of the topics the broader portions of things, from dystopian to philanthropic.
Yes, we have. Thank you so much, Joel.
Thank you very much, Lisa.
And to our audience, thank you for listening. And do join us next week for another edition of Credit Exchange. And follow us wherever you get your podcast. This has been your host, Lisa Lee.